You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ever since U.S. occupying forces began their withdrawal, we haven't heard as much about Iraq, although the country we left behind remains in terrible condition. Terrorist attacks are still all too frequent. The legal system remains convoluted and corrupt. And after two decades of war, the environment is in an awful state. Zayed al-Ali, an Iraqi lawyer, describes how and why the post-occupation Iraqi government has failed and explores what must be done in coming years to improve the prospects for his floundering country in a new book called The Struggle for Iraq's Future, How Corruption, Incompetence, and Sectarianism Have Undermined Democracy. It is published by Yale University Press and brings Zayed al-Ali to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, your father was in the Iraqi Foreign Service when you were born in 1977. That was 2 years before Saddam Hussein came to power. Was the Ba'ath Party any different under Ahmad Hassan al-Bakr?
It was slightly different, but the transition from Hassan Bekr's form of rule to Saddam Hussein was gradual. So during the 10 years when Hassan Bekr was in power, Saddam Hussein was gradually increasing his sphere of influence, particularly over the security sector. And the intelligence services, intimidation, corruption, and so on and so forth was gradually increasing. So it was a different type of party, but it was gradual.
What was your father's position on the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980 under Saddam Hussein?
Well, at first he was at the time my father was ambassador to the United Nations, so he was posted here in New York, and we were living here at the time. So obviously at first he was confused. He didn't know what the motivations were. He had some suspicion of what they were, but he didn't hear directly from the president or from his government.
Well, so, he had to defend Iraq at the UN.
For the initial period, sure. Then he traveled back to Iraq to seek instructions from and clarifications from his government. And when he heard the justifications and the clarifications and when he heard about the future plans for what the government was planning to do in Iran, he returned to New York and resigned immediately.
Uh-huh. And then became an oppositional figure?
Well, at first he didn't want to turn his resignation into a political statement because the war had already started. And, you know, from his perspective as an Iraqi, he didn't, you know, he thought it might be deemed as inappropriate to demoralize the troops, given that the war had already started, basically. So he said, listen, my conscience doesn't allow me to continue in this position. And what he particularly said to the foreign secretary and the president at the time was, I don't want to have to justify this to my children in the future. Right? But so for the initial period, he wasn't really active in the opposition until the invasion of Kuwait happened.
How much time did you spend living in Iraq when you were growing up?
None at all, actually.
So you were educated in the United States and in England?
That's right, yeah.
And studied law?
I studied law first in London, then in France, then in the States.
And what kind of law?
Well, mostly general law, then commercial law, arbitration law.
And you say that you had just started a job in Midtown, New York City on September 11th. Mm-hmm. You must have been surprised. Well, we were all surprised by what happened. But did you link it at all to Iraq, as the Bush administration seemed to almost immediately?
I mean, I didn't think that there was any way that the Iraqi government had anything to do with it because the means at their disposal were really, really minor. They were really a reduced country at that point. I realized that very shortly, that just like many people did at the time, that that some attention was going to be turned towards Iraq and that that there was going to be a focus on Iraq, but I didn't think there was any way that they had anything to do with it.
Well, you didn't believe that Saddam had links to al-Qaeda or that there were weapons of mass destruction?
I mean, I didn't believe...
Were you talking about this with your father?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my father didn't really look into it in as much detail as I did because he just based it on his understanding of the general situation. On the issue of weapons of mass destruction, I spent a lot of time personally looking into it because I wanted to decide whether I was personally in favor of the war or not. And I, you know, that issue of whether or not there were weapons or not was really determinant for me. So I spent a lot of time focusing on the weapons inspectors, what they were doing, what type of tests they were carrying out, the results, and so on and so forth. And by January 2003, I had basically concluded that it was impossible, that there was no way that there were any weapons.
What led your father to return to Iraq after the war began?
My father hadn't been to his country for decades. He was living in exile because of his resignation from his position. And he wanted to go back and just be in his country and see his family, you know. And he lived there for 3 years, and then from 2003 to 2006, and then just couldn't take it anymore and had to leave.
He had an insider's view, even though he hadn't been there for a while, of what was going on. What was his take on it?
I mean, he was my father was amongst those who were opposed to the occupation of the country, but also opposed to the previous regime. So he was in a minority position, because all those people that had returned to Iraq, many of them had decided to side with the occupation forces and try to get into government, whereas his position was that he wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Well, what was the response of other people there? Was he threatened at all? Was he still a prominent figure?
He was, and he still is today. So he still appears on television and does long interviews on pan-Arab channels and on Iraqi channels. But my father doesn't have a position. He's not a government figure. He's just someone whose opinion is asked that people ask to hear his opinion from time to time.
Well, you went to work for the UN.
I did.
And what did you do for them? Did you go to Iraq?
Yeah. So I was working for at first the United Nations Assistance Mission to Iraq. There was an office in that mission called the Office of Constitutional Support. And our role at the beginning was to provide legal advice to the constitutional drafters of the constitution. I did that for a while. Then I worked for UNDP, where I was focusing on legal and parliamentary reform and judicial structures.
And then you left. You've lived in Tunisia, and now you live in Egypt. Does that give you a kind of different perspective on what's going on in your homeland?
Yeah,
if we can call Iraq your homeland.
I mean, Iraq is the only real home I have, because I haven't lived long enough in any other place. And Iraq is the only place where I can go to where people welcome me as one of their own, and no one asks me when I'm going to go and leave, right?
Do you speak without an accent?
You know, people can tell that I've lived outside of Iraq, sure, you know, but I speak with an Iraqi dialect.
My guest is Zayed Al-Ali. His book, The Struggle for Iraq's Future, How Corruption, Incompetence, and Sectarianism Have Undermined Democracy. You outline five key elements that must be set in order to start moving Iraq toward a positive future: the armed forces, political parties, corruption, natural resources, and decentralization. But not sectarianism?
Well, sectarianism isn't a symptom. It's not something that's deep within Iraqi society. It's something that the politicians play up in order to forgive themselves for their failures. So whenever the Iraqi people, whenever people start demonstrating and protesting and rioting about the types of failures that the government has caused, so about electricity, services, healthcare, education, and so on and so forth, what the politicians always do is that they always rile up sectarian hatred. They always do it systematically.
But as I understand it, as somebody just following the history of Iraq from the perspective of living in New York City, during Saddam's period, he suppressed the Shiite majority, led to a lot of resentment. He also suppressed other minorities in the country. Today, when I read about a bombing, it's likely that it is Sunnis who have bombed a Shiite area, or Shiites who have bombed a Sunni area. So that's still going on, isn't it? And then there's a lot of the opposition to the president is that he is seen as a Shiite who has given preferential treatment to Shiites.
Sure, but those are actions by the politicians, right, and by terrorist groups. That's not actions by the general population. The relationship between us as Iraqis is exemplary. We have excellent relationships between us, you know. So
there was intermarriage before.
And there still is, you know. I mean, now it's a lot less because there's a lot less interaction. People don't move around as much as they used to, right? But, you know, I'm from a particular part of the country where people can really tell, you know, from my name and so on and so forth, what type of background I have, et cetera, et cetera. But I travel all over the country, and people treat me very, very well wherever I go. I'm never discriminated against. I never get any type of negative treatment. And that applies to everyone, you know. There are almost no recorded incidents of people at an individual level engaging in sectarian hatred and that type of thing. The types of explosions that you're talking about, those are actions by terrorists. You know, those are a tiny proportion of the population.
Just meant to kill as many innocent bystanders as they can.
Those are designed, you know, to sow hatred, right, specifically in order to play on these issues, right? But the issue is, why are these terrorist actions taking place, and how come they're taking place so easily? And that's one of the reasons why I cite the security sector as being in desperate need for reform.
So let's talk about the armed forces. Did the organization installed by the U.S. to run the country, Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, improve security in Iraq?
Well, I mean, there's no question that at an individual level, an individual Iraqi today living in his home or wherever is far less secure than before the war. Okay, so before the war, an individual Iraqi could go down the street, have a walk in the middle of the night, and have almost complete certainty that that individual will be able to get home safely, except if that individual was involved in politics, of course, right? Now it's a much more dangerous game. Now it's much more dangerous as an individual, right?
And these were based on decisions made by the U.S. occupying force, Paul Bremer, for example.
I mean, that's the result of a series of mistakes that were made, amongst others, by Paul Bremer, right? And one of the mistakes was, at first, the complete dissolution of all security sector forces in Iraq and just leaving the country completely unpoliced, unguarded at all. Right?
And they did that because they saw it as connected to the Ba'ath Party, and they were looking for some purity. But the only people who knew how to do it were people who had been in the security forces.
Sure, but people who today are running the security forces in Iraq, so Iraqis who are in charge of their own army today, most of those individuals come from the old army. And if you ask those individuals who are today very close to the current prime minister, what those individuals will tell you is that the army as an institution, as a general institution, was a professional army. The issue wasn't with the general army, it was with the special forces that were connected very closely to Saddam Hussein and his family. So, you know, they seem to think, those individuals who were in the army before the war seem to think that that was fine. Right?
Was the lack of sufficient security force why Iraq was so lawless between 2003 and 2008?
Sure, absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
Was the United States expecting to fill that vacuum with its own military?
I mean, they made a half-hearted attempt. So first of all, they never brought in enough soldiers in order to be able to do it properly. And even if they had, and they didn't, the problem was always going to be the lack of cultural knowledge about the country. So if you don't speak Arabic, you know, I was driving around Iraq on many occasions during those early days of the occupation, and we get stopped by American soldiers who are well-meaning, you know, and wanted to see, you know, where me and my cousins and my friends were going and so on and so forth. But it was always very difficult experience because they would ask for my ID, for example. My ID is all in Arabic. They can't read it. They can't tell if it's fake or if it's not fake, you know. And we couldn't communicate with them unless they asked me if I spoke English. In that case, I would say yes and speak to them. But on the occasions where they didn't, then there was no interaction. They couldn't tell anything about where we were going, where we weren't going, so on and so forth. That's not a real policing effort.
And they assumed that you didn't speak English.
On most occasions, they wouldn't ask if I spoke English, but sometimes they would.
Well, Paul Bremer's policies were founded on an assumption that sectarianism created the divisions in the population. He was wrong on that too?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, as you know, as an Iraqi, and all Iraqis know this very well, is that us as individuals, when we live in the country, we don't have the types of problems that they imagine. So Paul Bremer, in his book, My Year in Iraq, which he published very early on after he left Iraq.
In which you said, everybody else is at fault but me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things he described, he said, is that the reason why he dissolved the army is because he saw, in his opinion, the Sunni class, the officer class in the military were all Sunnis, and the regular soldier class, they were all Shia. And a Shia will never accept to implement an order from a Sunni. I mean, that's absolute nonsense, because if the order is coming from someone that they respect, it doesn't matter what religion he is or if he's religious at all.
So right? How was the Iraqi military eventually reestablished?
Well, it was established over a gradual period of time, and they're still working on it now.
What about training? It's been a big problem in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it's a big problem in Iraq too. And, you know, the level of professionalism in the military is quite low. Whenever there are security incidents, you find that a lot of them defect, and a lot of them tend to disappear when the going gets tough.
So how would you improve the military?
The first thing I would do is improve the chain of command. There's a major problem in the sense that the prime minister considers that he's in control over the entire armed forces. What he's done is, as a result of a very unclear constitutional provision, he's established an office called the Office of the Commander-in-Chief, which he controls. And he has the cell phone numbers for all of the officers in the military. And he calls them directly on their cell phones and gives them instructions about who to arrest, who to intimidate, and so on and so forth. That process needs to change.
Right? Well, I find it interesting that the leadership in both Iraq and in Afghanistan has been problematic for the United States. And yet we were, to a large degree, responsible for putting them in place.
Sure. I mean, there's a major problem, which is that, at least in Iraq, I can't really speak to Afghanistan, but when the United States occupied Iraq, it wasn't coming in a vacuum. There was a lot of history. There was a lot of baggage, right? So, you know, my view is that the only type of person of Iraqi that was willing to work with the United States occupying forces in that context, in the context of all of the baggage and all of the things that had been done in the past, including the wars and the bombings and so on and so forth, were those people who were willing to engage in moral compromise.
My guest is Zayed Al-Ali, who is a specialist in comparative constitutional law and international commercial arbitration, who was a legal advisor to the United Nations in Iraq from 2005 to 2010. He's written a book called The Struggle for Iraq's Future, How Corruption, Incompetence, and Sectarianism Have Undermined Democracy. It's published by Yale University Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Zayed Al-Ali. The Struggle for Iraq's Future is his book, subtitled How Corruption, Incompetence, and Sectarianism Have Undermined Democracy. It is published by Yale University Press. I am kind of unclear as to the political parties of Iraq. I just know that there are elections that, like so many other elections, people always complain that they were stacked against the opposition. But what are the political parties there, and are they pretty much along sectarian lines?
Yeah, so we have a lot of political parties, and most of them are very small. And a lot of those political parties group together in larger coalitions, so either electoral coalitions or parliamentary coalitions. And most of the parties, yes, do stack along sectarian lines because that's the system that was established, right? So they're just going along with the game that was created for them.
And what kinds of programs do they promote when they're running for office?
They hardly have any ideology, and the differences between them are really, really minor. There were some differences between them at the earlier stages. There were some that were promoting a looser federal structure rather than a stronger central system of government. But if you ask them about things like taxation, healthcare reform, or something like that, none of them will have any specific ideas about those things.
Weren't you a consultant on the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution? What did the Constitution say about political parties?
It allows for plurality and it allows for the formation of political parties along fairly free lines. So there aren't many conditions about forming political parties. But the system of government and the general mood of the country after the war was one of ethno-sectarian formation. So the first government that was formed in the country after the initial invasion, was formed by the U.S. occupation along an exact ethno-sectarian formulation. And even members of the Communist Party were forced to fall in line and to tell what, you know, to give the people who were forming the government their religion.
I'm a Sunni communist, I'm a Shiite communist.
That type of thing, yeah.
Well, after the 2009-2010 elections, the two majorities in the parliament, the State Alliance and the Iraqiya Alliance, seem to have similar stances for the first time. And many believe that progress might finally be made. Why were they unable then to come to terms?
They were unable to come to terms because our political class, our political elite in Iraq, are amongst the most selfish and incompetent that one could possibly imagine. These individuals only care about themselves and about their own positions. There's no real allegiance or ideology in favor of a resurgent Iraq or a stable Iraq or a prosperous Iraq or anything like that.
And the voters are unaware of this?
Well, the voters in any event don't really have any choice, right? So, you know, me as an Iraqi citizen, I don't really know who to vote for. It's not as if there are good candidates out there who I can really vote for that have a stance, that have a chance of winning, right? So out of all of the bad options, they preferred the Iraqi Alliance and the State of Law Coalition because they thought that those two had a better chance of forming a government. But in the end, they were highly, highly disappointed.
And what role has Prime Minister al-Maliki played in all of this? Al-Maliki, is it?
Al-Maliki, yeah. So al-Maliki was initially chosen to be prime minister at a time when he was somewhat unknown amongst the general population. He was known amongst political circles, but not really amongst the general population. And he was chosen because he was a weak candidate. They thought that he was going to be the person who wouldn't really threaten the larger parties. So with time, his power structure increased, and he seized control over the courts and the military. And now he's determined to stay in power for as long as possible, right? So we have elections now coming up at the end of April, theoretically at least, and he's trying to set himself up for a third term.
Well, so how can things be improved? You say corruption is endemic.
Mm-hmm.
People are perfectly happy with the politicians are perfectly happy with the situation because they're all getting their own little piece of the pie.
Or big piece of the pie, yeah.
So there's absolutely no incentive to change things, to improve things.
Well, for them, there isn't a direct incentive, but often what can happen is that despite the misery that we're living in Iraq, there's still a glimmer of hope. And at times, what can happen is that the politicians, are, despite themselves and despite their best intentions, are sometimes forced to behave along a better standard of behavior. And they're forced often by civil society, by society as a whole. So, and by society as a whole, I mean religious institutions, intellectuals, academics, who often have a very negative opinion about the politicians and who will insist that certain reforms take place. And that's the type of that's the sort of thing that can be capitalized on to force the politicians to enter into certain types of reforms.
Were these politicians underprepared to rule because one of the litmus tests was that they had not been part of the Ba'ath Party and Saddam Hussein's government?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you just take any one of the senior ministers in government now and you look at their backgrounds, it's fairly remarkable. If you look at, for example, the prime minister, and I don't focus on the prime minister because I have anything in particular against him. It just happens to be the case that he's the prime minister. But the prime minister doesn't have a university degree, lived for 20 years in exile where he didn't really have a real job, and then suddenly is brought back to Iraq and becomes prime minister, you know, suddenly, and is running the whole country. That's not really the type of background that's conducive to being a professional leader.
With so much corruption and theft apparent during the time you were there, did you believe that your efforts with the UN to create a legal framework and a parliament could make much of a difference?
We hope so at first, and maybe we did, you know, a little bit. I'm not really sure. In the big scheme of things, our efforts turned, you know, were fairly minor in the end, right?
And corruption wound up ruling. Have there been any efforts to fight corruption?
I mean, theoretically, the government has a position that encourages anti-corruption efforts, and they have an anti-corruption body, which theoretically is supposed to be working against corruption, but the government does all it can to undermine those efforts behind the scenes. So it's all just for show.
My guest is Zayd Al-Ali. His book, The Struggle for Iraq's Future, How Corruption, Incompetence, and Sectarianism Have Undermined Democracy. It's published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The 2005 Constitution did nothing to rebuild the national oil industry, but it did gain favorable terms with international corporations. Did that strategy succeed?
Well, it depends what you mean by the strategy. So if the strategy was to open up the Iraqi oil market to international corporations, to a certain extent it succeeded because the corporations are now very present in Iraq. They have lots of contracts and they're working and so on and so forth. But you can also argue that it was unsuccessful because oil production has not really increased to a significant extent over the past 10 years.
Well, Dick Cheney argued when we invaded that the oil would pay for the invasion and for reconstruction and everything else. Why, since Iraq has so much oil, hasn't it been able to increase its production?
Because of issues like corruption, incompetence, you know, that type of thing. You know, the way in which the contracts are structured, the way in which they're overseen by the government. If you were aware of the details, you wouldn't believe some of it.
What about the role of the Kurdish area in the north in oil production? Isn't that where much of the oil is?
No, the largest bulk of the oil is in the south of the country.
Near Kuwait.
Near Kuwait, that's right. So near Basra city, that type of thing, right? So that's by far where the largest deposits are. But there are significant deposits in the north as well.
Saddam Hussein claimed when he invaded Kuwait that they were stealing Iraq's oil by, what, extending the equivalent of straws into Iraq underground?
Yeah, what the idea is that it was, what they said was that it was vertical, horizontal drilling, they were saying. So they would drill down, then through the border. That was the idea.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't really have any special knowledge about that. But regardless of whether or not it was true, obviously it doesn't justify an invasion.
Has sabotage been a factor in preventing more oil production?
Sure. Sabotage has been a factor, of course. Yeah, sabotage is a factor in relation to lots of things. But the main factors are just mismanagement. That's the main issue.
And it's also had an impact on the environment, hasn't it?
Well, the environment is in a really bad state now in Iraq. So the oil sector has had a bad impact. But more generally speaking, what's had a very negative impact now on the environment is the decline and almost disappearance of the agricultural sector. So we have major problems with upstream dams being constructed. We have a lot less rainfall than we used to have, and there's no electricity as well in the countryside. So people can't irrigate their lands to the extent that they used to, and everything's basically drying up and dying.
But we're talking about the area that used to be called the Fertile Crescent between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Are those rivers not as full as they used to be?
They're not as full as they used to be, and projections are they're going to continue declining over the future.
Well, Saddam also drained the wetlands, but haven't they been replenished to some degree?
So what they did is that they tried to open up the barrages that Saddam Hussein had constructed to drain the wetlands, and to a certain extent they were reflooded. But they're nowhere near, they don't cover anywhere near the same area that they used to because of reduced rainfall, upstream dams in Turkey and in Iran and so on and so forth. It's becoming a major, major problem, and the way in which it's manifesting itself is in these incredible dust storms that are taking place all the time now, making life in Iraq a real misery. And, you know, it really feels like when you're in a dust storm, it's like some type of Mad Max environment where, you know, the country is basically unlivable.
Well, is it in the best interest of Turkey and Iran to hoard the water? Isn't unrest in Iraq a problem for them as well?
I'm sure it is. I don't really know how they formulate their policies.
Diplomacy would resolve some of this. Is that a problem right now?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because relations between the Iraqi government and the Turkish government are very, very negative, partly as a result of the Iraqi government's behavior, but also because the Turks don't really feel that there's much incentive for them to improve the relations. And in relation to Iran, the relationship is very one-sided. So I don't think the Iraqis feel that there's anything they can impose on the Iranians.
Well, the general consensus for a while was that Iran was the ultimate victor of the invasion of Iraq. Does it still look that way?
I mean, they certainly haven't lost anything. You know, they've gained a lot and they haven't lost anything. Some people have also said that Iran was the major player in Iraq and so on and so forth. I wouldn't go that far. But they certainly haven't lost anything, sure.
In the case of Turkey, there's also a conflict over Kurds because Turkey has its Kurdish insurrection and the Kurds of Iraq border on Turkey.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. And so there's a suspicion, some people suspect that the Turkish government is trying to form like a buffer state between Iraq and itself and trying to promote the Kurdistan region to try to turn it into some type of buffer state. But there are differing interests there, so I'm not sure how far that could go.
Well, there was a call for Kurdistan within Turkey, so they can just push it all into Iraq and resolve that problem for themselves?
Yeah, possibly, but I just don't see that. I just see that as being a little bit too far-fetched. I'm not an expert on those areas, but I just see that as just being too far-fetched.
Well, how would you change the approach Iraq has taken toward its natural resources?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that I would do is that I would reinvigorate the National Oil Company. Because previously, whenever you would speak to Iraqis back in the old days, in the 70s and the 80s, people were very proud of their National Oil Company. They were very proud of Iraqi engineers. Iraqi engineers were very proud of themselves. And they were really looked upon as being these national heroes, you know, people that people looked up to. Today, that's something that's really missing in our country. We don't have the types of, you know, national heroes or identity, you know, people that people look up to in the country. So it would be good if more of an effort were done in that regard in order to turn it into some type of symbol of unity amongst people working from all types of backgrounds to work towards this that common goal.
Joe Biden once suggested that Iraq be broken up into a number of different states, and to some degree there has been a push for a federal approach. The Kurds have gained a certain amount of independence, but is part of the problem that you have both centralized government and decentralized governments at conflict?
That's not really the reason why there's a problem there. The reason why there's a problem is, first of all, because Iraqis don't want the type of solution that Joe Biden suggested for us. First, we know that based on 10 years of polling data and 10 years of elections, all political parties that have argued along the lines that Joe Biden suggested have done very, very poorly in elections. So it's clear that Iraqis don't want that type of solution. And the other reason why that type of solution won't work for us is because it would lead to a perpetual conflict in the sense that there's no clear border between the different peoples of the country. Trying to divide us up into three neat areas would lead to a huge amount of conflict between all sorts of areas. And that would be a disaster with no end.
There's a serious problem in Fallujah right now. How is the al-Maliki government handling it?
Very badly. They have a problem because of their own security sector is infiltrated by militias. and they have a problem because the security sector as well isn't really up for the fight. They don't really feel like confronting people face-to-face. And they have a problem with their operating procedures, which is bombing from afar, not really knowing where the bombs are landing. And the impact now is that 50% of the civilian population of those areas, of the entire province, has now left their homes and are now displaced internally within Iraq.
How much of a U.S. military presence is there these days?
In Iraq?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe at the embassy a little bit, but there, and maybe advisors here and
there. So there's nothing really that the United States can do to resolve some of these problems?
Maybe from afar and in terms of advice and that type of thing, but in terms of actually fighting on the ground, at least, you know, openly and officially, there's nothing. There may be things behind, I've got no idea, but I doubt it. You know?
So we're not following Colin Powell's old advice that if you break it, you have to pay for it.
I mean, you know, the Iraqis are supposedly trying to deal with this on their own, supposedly. They may be getting some form of indirect assistance, but not directly.
Now, you live in Cairo now.
Yes.
Is that out of the frying pan and into the fire?
Well,
do you have much hope for Egypt in the coming years?
I have hope for the long term, right? So I'm very confident that Egypt will really become one of the leading democracies in the region, and if not even further than the region. In the short term, things aren't looking so great. You know, there are lots of problems in the country. But what I should say as well is that in terms of my home and my family and so on and so forth, we're comfortable, we're fine. You know, our neighborhood's okay. In fact, most neighborhoods are okay. It's mostly, you know, politics in the country. The political situation is really, really terrible.
Well, isn't part of the problem in the Middle East that politics and religion often get mixed up with each other? And that leads to all sorts of tensions that might not have occurred otherwise?
That's one of the problems, sure. But I think that there's a more direct and more important problem, which is a problem of authoritarianism, you know, and repression by authoritarian regimes. You know,
and why is it so open to authoritarian regimes? I mean, you had Lebanon, which was a functioning democracy, and now it is a total mess.
I mean, it's always been kind of a mess. I mean, Lebanon has always had elections, right? Whether or not you can qualify it as having ever been a real democracy in the sense that Americans think of it, that would be a little bit difficult. It's a free society and they have elections, but whether or not it's actually a real democracy is difficult to say. And it's been a mess for a very long time and it continues to be a mess today. Yeah, that's true. But as your question as to
then
why
Syria is
sure. I mean, you know, Syria. I've been to Syria many, many times, and it's a great country, and the people are really fantastic. But they've been suffering for a long time under their authoritarian regime, and one hopes for a better future for them. I don't really know how it's going to come, but then when it's going to happen. But,
well, Assad again is one of those people who says, if I leave office, sectarianism will take over and we'll see bloodbaths. Of course, he's creating his own bloodbath.
That's right. There's already a bloodbath anyway, right? And there's been a bloodbath anyway for decades because, you know, the killing that's today happening in the streets previously was happening in prisons, right? So it's just, it's a lot more open nowadays and perhaps there's a lot more of it. But one of the, you know, if what he says is true, that if he were to leave office and then the floodgates would be open and all hell would be run loose and so on and so forth, he would be one of the causes of that because they've eliminated all type of legitimate opposition in the country. In the country, not just in Syria, that's the case throughout. So, you know, throughout the region, all of the regimes that we've had to deal with in Iraq, it was the same. You know, all types of liberal parties, nationalist parties, communist parties, and so on and so forth. They were all completely devastated, and so people just retreated back to their primordial instincts, which is race, religion, that type of thing. Those things that you can't eliminate, no matter what you do. And that's all we're left with today after decades of dictatorial rule.
Well, thank you so much for that rosy forecast. Zayd al-Ali, his book, The Struggle for Iraq's Future, How Corruption, Incompetence, and Sectarianism Have Undermined Democracy. It's published by Yale University Press. It's been enlightening. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.